morning. Thank you so much for coming. When I was younger, I had the opportunity to travel with my family to Parris Island, which is the Marine Corps training base down south near roundabouts North Carolina. And right off the coast, it's a little island. And we went there and we had a gunnery sergeant, who, at least within the rank and file, is relatively high ranking, take us around the facility and show us the different training grounds and the barracks and tell us a little bit about the history of the Marine Corps and so on and so forth. And I'll never forget her. She was a short, sort of stocky woman from Hawaii who was really built like a tank, incredibly clipped and straight-laced and tough, and who'd seen it all, had been a veteran of two different campaigns, and her name was Sergeant Principe, a wonderful, wonderful person. And at a certain point, you know, she talked about how difficult it was for people who, as they rise up through the ranks of the Marine Corps, need to move around the country or around the world, how difficult it is for their families. But she said it in this very sort of nonchalant, off-the-cuff way that seemed very sort of incongruous with sort of the affecting subject matter that she was speaking about. So at a certain point, as she's talking about how difficult it is, but sort of brushing it off, my uncle turned to her and said, "You know, Sergeant, are you, by any chance, are you married? Do you have a family?" And she said, "Sir, if the Marine Corps wanted me to have a husband, it would have issued me one." Now, we're used to thinking about tight-knit groups like the Marines or like religious groups or what have you as having sort of distinctive characteristics, rules that structure their society, and features that make them recognizable both to each other and to the outside world. Now, the upshot of this is that over time, as groups come into contact with each other and come into sometimes friction with each other, and especially as sort of groups get larger and more successful, you begin to recognize distinctive features as not merely interesting or as not mere curiosities, but as problems. And this is when we get to think about terms like heresy. So if you have a large group, let's take a religious group, although it's not confined only to religion. If a large religious group, and you want to start figuring out who belongs in and who belongs out, you can start to seize on people's distinctive features and problematize them. For example, you can say this person is, it's not just that this person thinks something different than I do, or this person acts differently than I do. This person's differences are in fact definitional to who they are. They define who they are, and the term that we have come up with in the modern era for this process is heresy. This person is a heretic, and when you call someone a heretic, that marks them as being outside your community. Now, my question is this. The term heresy, when I throw out the term heresy, what are your associations with it? So what do you think of, just throw out some words, what do you think of when you think of the term heresy? Ah, anti-religion, in the sense that heresy is anti-religion. Okay, so you think religion, yeah? Ah, so there are particular characters within a religious tradition, Elisha ben Avuya, whom you associate with heresy. What else? Martyrdom. Interesting. Ah, let's think about martyrdom for a second. So when you think of martyrdom, do you think of any particular religion? Joan of Arc. Ah, interesting. That's exactly what I was going for. When you think of the term heresy, the English word heresy, which religion do you think of? Christianity. And in fact, the term heresy in the lexicon, sort of in the history of human writing, appears most often in that tradition, although it doesn't originate there. The term heresy, does anyone know where the term heresy comes from? It's an English, it's sort of an anglicized word, but originally it's a Greek word, hieresis. And the Greek word hieresis is a term that long precedes, by hundreds and hundreds if not thousands of years, that long precedes the advent of Christianity. And in fact, you can find it in ancient Greek and even ancient Jewish literature that's written in Greek. And so what I'd like to do as we think about the term heresy is think about where it comes from. Now, why are we interested in heresy at all? We live in an age, whether we think about our own Jewish community, or whether we think about sort of the broader global Jewish population, or whether we think about society as a whole, American politics, global politics, we are in an era right now where it feels more immediate than ever before to think in terms of heretics or in terms of tribes. People segment themselves off from other people on the basis of ideology. It is more common now than ever before, as an economic study published in the Journal of National Economics recently concluded. It's now more common than it has ever been at any point since this has been measured in American history for people to marry each other on the basis of ideology, on political ideology. So now it's more common than ever before for Republicans to marry Republicans, for Democrats to marry Democrats, for Libertarians to marry Libertarians, and so on and so forth. We are more and more segmenting ourselves off into different tribes, and often when we do so, we talk about those who are not members of our tribes, not as if they're simply different from us, but as if there is something condemnable about them. And often the term that we either use specifically to describe this, or the implicit term that we're thinking about when we do describe others as outside based on the foundation of ideology, is heresy. So what I'd like to do is take the term heresy, subject it to a historical analysis, figure out where the term comes from, figure out where the term how it instantiates within the context of modern literature, and then ask ourselves, does this term have an analog? Does it have a comparandum in Jewish literature? Now, if I ask you sort of bluntly to sort of presage the answer, so does the term heretic have a counterpart in Jewish texts, in Chazal, for example? Apikoros. So the term most often, I think, associated with this notion, certainly in modern Jewish literature, is apikoros. Now, it is fascinating to note that as far as Chazal are concerned, so first of all, what is apikoros a sort of Hebraified form of? Epicurean, right? So a person who is a follower of Epicurus, who's one of three great philosophers, or perhaps in our case, infamous philosophers of the post-Aristotelian Greek world. But what's fascinating is that in the context of Chazal, when Chazal defined the term apikoros, although the Rambam changes this, when Chazal defined the term apikoros, the term apikoros is used to designate somebody who speaks mockingly of a rabbi or of the Torah by referring to the Torah, for example, as a safra, as just another book. So someone says, "Oh, the book says," or "the good book says," that is taken to be a form of Epicureanism. So it's not associated with wrong thinking or wrong belief, which is how we usually think about heresy. Any other terms? What other terms can we think of? Minim, excellent. So a min, somebody who is a min. How would you translate the term min if you had to translate it into English without using the word heretic? Species. So where does the term min come up most frequently? If you had to think about sort of Parshas HaShavua. So think about Bereishis, precisely. Think about Maisa Bereishis. You talk about pre-Eitz Laminehu, and so on and so forth. Everything according to its own species. So min, you might translate as heretic, but it also is translated as species, as something distinctive, and we'd have to think about what the relationship between those terms are. Now, before we dive into the sources themselves, so let me throw out a question for you in terms of defining the terms of this discussion. If we're going to ask ourselves, a kofer, right? Someone who is guilty of kfira, or who's kofer bi'ikar. So the term kofer usually appears in Chazal as a noun, rather as a verb, somebody who is kofer, somebody who denies things or who suppresses something. The term used as a noun doesn't appear until later, but we have to ask ourselves, who is doing the kfira? What is the term for somebody who does kfira? So in later literature, it's a kofer. It's someone who does kfira. But what's the term is there a term in Chazal? So before we move forward and ask ourselves, what does the term heresy mean originally? How does it appear? Does it appear in Chazal? First, let's set the terms a little bit, define the terms a little bit, by setting our expectations for what heresy might mean. So when you think about the term heresy, so what do you think about? What's wrong with a heretic? What is a heretic doing wrong? So against Hashem. Now, that perhaps might be within the context of contemporary Jewish discussion, but let's say you're a Christian. Let's say you're a Muslim. What does it mean? What's wrong with, or let's say you're Jewish. If a Jewish person, a Muslim person, and a Christian person, sounds like the setup for a joke. Let's say they're all using the term heretic. What does it mean? Precisely. You're thinking something wrong. You're not thinking rightly. Precisely. So the problem with what a heretic does, or what makes a person a heretic, is thinking the wrong thing. It is wrong belief. That, I think, is how we use the term heretic nowadays. Okay. So how does this term appear in the earliest instances in which we can find it? So take a look at source number one. At least by the time it makes its way into ancient Jewish literature, the term hieresis, which is the ancestor of the modern word heresy, appears in one of its earliest instances in Jewish writing in the work of Josephus. Does anyone know who Josephus is? So who is Josephus? Ah, so Svarim Chitzoniyim. So the term Svarim Chitzoniyim, where do we find that term? Right, so Chazal refer to certain outside books. Right, and we refer to them as apocryphal. It's not exactly clear what the Svarim Chitzoniyim were. Svarim Chitzoniyim it's not exactly clear what they are because we don't have a list of them. The question is Josephus considered a Sefer Chitzoni, an outside book? It's unlikely because the term Sefer in rabbinic literature usually refers to a scriptural book, and Josephus isn't a scriptural work, it's just a book of history. He's a general and a historian. Excellent. So Josephus is a general in which war? Against whom? Against the Romans. Now, how many times did our people fight major wars against the Romans? At least once. Bar Kokhba is the other one. And the Churban HaBayis. Those are the two major ones. Precisely. So, over the course of our two wars against the Romans, so the first war takes place between about the years 65 and 69 of the Common Era, and then culminating sort of in a catastrophe in the year 70 when the Second Temple, the Beit HaMikdash, is destroyed. And the second one takes place between the years 132 and 135 of the Common Era, which is known to history as Mered Bar Kokhba, as the Bar Kokhba Revolt. Okay. Josephus is a general leading Jewish troops in the area of the Galil, in the Galilee, during the first war, during the war against the Romans. And he writes an entire history of the war, which is translated in English as the war. But he's also written a number of other very important works. He wrote an autobiography called the Vita, called the Life. And he also wrote a multi-volume series called the Antiquities, the Antiquities of the Jews. The Antiquities is Josephus's history of the Jewish people from essentially the beginning of Chumash ad Hayom Hazeh. Okay. Now, why is Josephus important? Why do we care what Josephus thinks? And Josephus is useful for a bunch of things, but what are they? Why do we care what Josephus thinks? First of all, if Josephus were called up for an aliyah, what would he be called up as? Yosef ben Matityahu. That's the name that appears to be his Hebrew name. But would it be Yosef Matityahu ben Matityahu Shlishi? What would it be? Yamod Yosef ben Matityahu HaKohen. Precisely. Josephus was a priest. Now, why is this very, very important? Nowadays, if you're a Kohen, so it's great. Listen, you get paid off a little bit during the Pidgin HaBen. There's some benefits. There are a couple Matnos Kuna you can do in Eretz Yisrael. But precisely. Josephus was alive at a time when the Beit HaMikdash was standing. And as a priest, as a Kohen, he was able to walk into the Beit HaMikdash. And he performed Avodah in the Beit HaMikdash. And therefore, when Josephus tells us, as he does in great detail, what the Beit HaMikdash looked like, what the which utensils were where, how the service went, what the other Kohanim were like, he's a unique source of information because he was an eyewitness. Okay. Why else is Josephus important? How many other historians were writing during the time of Josephus? The many were writing during the time of Josephus. In fact, Josephus tells us about them. And moreover, Josephus was upset at all of them because they all appeared to have hated Josephus. So Josephus had many literary rivals throughout the ancient Jewish world. Now, of those many historians, in particular, a rival of Josephus named Yochanan of Gushchalav, which is translated into English as Yochanan, rather of John of Giscala. Of all of those historians who were writing during the first century, how many of them survive? One, Josephus. So Josephus is our only source of eyewitness historical testimony for the first century of the Common Era. And moreover, he is also our only source of any historical writing, well, not as an eyewitness, although he does appear to preserve earlier sources in some cases, of the several hundred years prior, going back to the time of Alexander. And unlike Chazal, who are far more interested kedarkam bakodesh in the theological implications of history than in recording history itself. Chazal aren't writing sort of biology or historical textbooks. Josephus isn't interested or even competent to assess things the way that Chazal were, to assess the theological status of anything the way Chazal were, but he was a historian. He was trying to collect facts, and he saw that as his main task. So Josephus is very important. Now, there are very important drawbacks, or very serious drawbacks, to using Josephus as a source. The most important of which is that Josephus was a megalomaniac and a narcissist. And Josephus is therefore, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, and I'm not a psychiatric expert, but like many people, at least in the popular stereotype, like many people who are affected with those conditions, Josephus can oftentimes be untrustworthy. And therefore, we have to be very careful when we use Josephus, because Josephus can tell us, in other words, if Josephus tells us that X, person X, is a horrible person, he tortured babies and he wore white after Labor Day. I mean, Josephus oftentimes has an axe to grind, and therefore we have to be very careful about assessing Josephus's motivations. However, that said, when Josephus is, to use the halachic parlance, mesiach lefitumo, when Josephus tells us things sort of off the cuff, without any, as far as we can tell, without any incentive or without giving any indication that he is being misleading, then we actually have a very valuable source of information for things that were going on at a formative, crucial point in Jewish history. So this is one example. Josephus tells us in his autobiography, in the Wita, in the Life, the following. He says, when I was about 16 years old, I had a mind to comprehend the several hereseon that were among us. The hereseon is, in grammatically speaking, that's what's called a plural genitive, but it's basically just the term hereses. See, I looked at a bunch of different heresies when I was 16 years old. And these heresies are three. The first is that of the Pharisees, the second the Sadducees, and the third that of the Essenes, as we have frequently told you, and Josephus elaborates upon the details of these different groups many other times in his work. For I thought that by this means I might choose the best, if I were once acquainted with them all. So when I had accomplished my desires, I returned back to the city, being now 19 years old, and began to conduct myself according to the rules of the heresy of the Pharisees, which is like that of the Stoics, as the Greeks call them. So what is Josephus describing here? Between the ages of, after age 16, what did he do? Yeah, he went for a year in Israel. Precisely. Not only did he go for a year in Israel, but he stayed Shana Gimel. So Josephus spends 3 years studying the heresies of the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. Now, okay, so let's talk about who the people are, who are the cast of characters. Okay, let's start with the Essenes. The Essenes are, we don't really know much about them. There are many historians who think that they are the same sort of group behind many of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's a controversial opinion. I'm not sold myself. But at the very least, we don't know very much about who the Essenes were, because it's not clear that we have any of their writings. But the Essenes are sort of an exclusive group of people who either, in some cases, live off by themselves in small enclaves, or they live in sort of communities embedded within larger cities. They are very strict about whom they eat with, and rules of purity, and so on and so forth. So the Essenes are a particular group for whom Josephus had a great deal of respect, but whom he ultimately doesn't follow in his public life. Who are the Sadducees? What's the term that the Mishnah uses for them? Tzedukim, right? So precisely. The Sadducees are, we also don't know very much about them, and part of the problem is that we tend to retroject our sort of modern conception of people who are anti-rabbinic or non-rabbinic back onto previous non-rabbinic people. So, for example, people who study the Karaites, historians who study the Karaites, sort of the famous anti-rabbinites of the medieval period, will often complain that people nowadays think that Karaites must have been big mekilim. They must have been very lenient. Why? Because people who are non-rabbinic Jews nowadays typically tend to be very lenient in their observance, and so people assume that Karaites must have been the same way. In fact, Karaites were much far stricter about their religious practice than the rabbis. It's just that they completely rejected any notion of Torah Shebaal Peh, which of course put them outside the Machane. Now, in turn, people tend to assume that because the Karaites, and in fact many of the Rishonim assume this, because that was what they knew, because the Karaites were infamous for rejecting any notion of Torah Shebaal Peh, any notion of extra scriptural tradition, people assumed that the Sadducees and the Essenes, and people behind the Dead Sea Scrolls, must also have rejected any notion of Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, the problem is that Josephus tells us exactly the opposite. However, it is the case that when it comes to the Sadducees, Josephus tells us that the Sadducees did not accept any traditions that were outside of Scripture. Now, the Sadducees, as we know from other sources, had all different creative ways of interpreting Scripture that were not necessarily what we might call Pshuto Shel Mikra. However, it is the case that the Sadducees appear to have rejected the notion that there were halachos that we have that are extra-scriptural, that are non-scriptural. So these Sadducees are sort of another group within early Judaism that had a raised public profile. And finally, that brings us to the Pharisees. Who are the Pharisees? How did the Mishnah refer to them? The Prushim, precisely. And the Prushim are whom? How are we related to the Prushim? Or how the Prushim... Right. So we typically tend to describe the Prushim as our sort of intellectual ancestors, and we see them as the forerunners of whom? Right, of Orthodoxy, or in more historically proximate, who are they the forerunners of? Right, Chazal, precisely. We see them as sort of the ancestors of Chazal. Now, it is noteworthy that no member of Chazal is ever described as a Prushi. No member of Chazal who's called a rabbi, who has the title Rav, is ever described by Chazal as a Prushi. And it is further noteworthy that in tandem with that, no person who is ever described as a Prushi by Chazal is ever called a Rav, is ever called a rabbi. And there are times where Chazal appeared to be quite negative about the Prushim. So for example, as we'll see in just a moment, there is a bracha that Chazal have, that Chazal prescribe in Shemoneh Esrei. It's sort of, at least if the Bavli is to be followed, it's sort of a 19th bracha, which is called Birkas Haminim. We'll get back to Birkas Haminim in just a second. But Birkas Haminim is sort of a bracha about Minim. Now, when I say a bracha, what do I really mean? What bracha am I referring to? That what's the lashon of Yisuf? V'la mal shinim al tihisikva v'chal yishak v'yakdaved v'chule v'chule. So when I say it's a bracha about minim, what do I really mean? It's a klala, meaning it's a curse about the minim, that we should not be like the minim and the minim should be destroyed. Chazal believed that there was another bracha that paired with that bracha and had a similar theme to that bracha, and it's called Birkat HaPrushim, the bracha against the Prushim. There are other times within Chazal where Chazal appear to be quite negative about the Prushim. Therefore, my question to you is, before we move any further, because this is important to establish, why do we say, and I think say it correctly, but why do we tend to think that the Prushim were in fact our forerunners, and that we should see ourselves within the context of their legacy? What evidence do we have that the Prushim have anything to do with Chazal, whom we follow, and who are the Baalei HaMasorah? Yeah? So that's a good point, meaning the question is, chronologically, when did all these groups overlap with each, did they overlap with each other? So Josephus appears to say that they were contemporaries with each other. And certainly by the time of the Bavli, the Prushim have been interpreted as the good guys. But even in the times of the Mishnah, when there appear to have been some negative feelings about the Prushim amongst Chazal, so they win, in other words, because they're the winners. It could be. Even Josephus, even during his time, says that the Prushim were the most popular. So there are a couple of examples. One of them is Birkas HaPrushim is considered to have the same theme as Birkas HaMinim, which is that we curse, just like we curse the Minim, we also curse the Prushim. That's in the Tosefta. We're going to see it in just a moment. I think there are some core pieces of evidence that do demonstrate that, in fact, the Prushim are our forerunners, and we should see them as our ancestors and key members of the Baalei HaMasorah. In fact, some of the evidence comes from Josephus himself, although not exclusively. The most important evidence comes from the Mishnah. But how is Josephus helpful? Because Josephus lived during this time and tells us about a lot of the different types of people with whom he interacted. And in fact, Josephus tells us about some very prominent Pharisees with whom he interacted. One of them, who was his neighbor and with whom he records conversations, was a person by the name of Simeon ben Gamaliel. Now, who is Simeon ben Gamaliel? What do we call him? We call him Shimon ben Gamaliel, but what title do we give him? He may have been the Nasi. It's unclear. It's the Machlokas Yerushalmi in the Bavli. Rabban Shimon ben Gamaliel. He is a rabbi. He's Rabbi Shimon ben Gamaliel. So here we have an example, not within Chazal itself, but we do have an example of someone that Chazal clearly identify as part of the Masorah, as a Rav, and as a major Talmud Chacham, and as a person of impressive tzidkus, whom Josephus informs us, Chazal may not have thought it was important, but whom Josephus informs us was also a Pharisee. What's another example? This time you don't even need to go to Josephus, go to the book of Acts. The book of Acts tells us that one of the members of the Sanhedrin was a person by the name of Gamaliel. Who is that? Who is Gamaliel? Right, his father. And what title does he have? Rabban Gamaliel, Rabbi Gamaliel. And we have another case where a member of the Sanhedrin who's identified by the book of Acts, Messiah Lefitumo, as a Pharisee, who clearly is a member of the rabbinic class. So there, those are some important pieces of circumstantial evidence, but most importantly, the Mishnah, although there are times Mishnah, and we'll see why in just a moment, there are times where the Mishnah or the Tanaim appear to have thought that the Prushim, that the model of the Prushim could be improved upon in important ways. Notwithstanding, as far as halacha is concerned, whenever the Prushim argue with anyone else, as far as the Mishnah is concerned, whose side are we on? The Prushim. We're always on the side of the Prushim as far as halacha is concerned, which is an important point. Okay. So now to get back to Josephus. Josephus tells us that during his year in Israel and all through Shana Bet and Shana Gimel, so he studies all the different heresies, and he finally settles on which one? The Prushim. Now, Josephus isn't himself a Pharisee, and in fact he doesn't like the Pharisees. He says nasty things about them throughout his works. However, in public, as he says here, I conducted myself according to the rules of the heresy of the Pharisees, because they were the most popular. That's why Josephus wanted to be in with the people. Now, when Josephus uses the term heresy here to describe all the different philosophies that he studied and that he took very seriously and the best of which he wanted to find, how is he using the term heresy? Does it have negative implications? It doesn't appear to. The term heresy doesn't appear to mean anything bad at all. What does it sound like it means? A belief system. And in fact, I think the hint about what he means by the term heresy is all the way at the end of the passage where he compares the Pharisees to whom? The Stoics. Now, who are the Stoics? We mentioned the Epicureans before. One of the other great and famous schools of Greek philosophy were the Stoics. And when we talk about Stoics, Epicureans, and Aristotelians, Peripatetics, and so on and so forth, we are describing not different communities, we're not describing different sects, we're not describing different shuls, we're describing schools of thought. And in fact, many of the Jewish writers, like Josephus, another person named Philo, who lived in Egypt, when Jews who write in Greek describe the different sort of types of expressions of Judaism in this era, they often, and in particular when they're writing for a non-Jewish audience, as Josephus in part is, they always describe these different groups in terms that their audience would understand. So they always compare them to different schools of Greek philosophy because they wanted to convey the idea that these different groups of Judaism represented different sort of ideologies or philosophies. So what Josephus means when he uses the term heresy here is nothing more than and with no implications beyond the term philosophy. The term heresy simply means school of thought. Okay. Now let's take a look down at source number 2. You can look at sources 1b and 1c, which will give you sort of the same impression. But let's take a look at source number 2. What we will find if we review all of the evidence is that at an early stage, the term heresy, in particular as it's used by Jews writing during the era of the Beit HaMikdash, is that the term heresy in Greek, as it is used by Greek writers who aren't Jewish, the term heresy simply means school of thought, with no negative or positive implications one way or another. Eventually, the term heresy comes to take on a very specific meaning, namely, bad school of thought. And this occurs in particular, and really exclusively, in the writings of the early Christians. And that brings us to source number 2, which comes to us from a fellow named Irenaeus. Irenaeus, for those who are not familiar, Irenaeus is the bishop of Lyon in Gaul, in France, who eventually sort of travels around the ancient world. He makes his way to Eretz Israel at a certain point to teach and to research and so on and so forth. His magnum opus is a work called Against Heresies. And Irenaeus, in this book, tells us what he's going to do. So he tells us the following. Now let's read carefully and see if we can figure out what Irenaeus' goals are, what his rhetorical goals are. So Irenaeus says, I write this book in order that you, obtaining an acquaintance with these things, may in turn explain to all those with whom you're connected and exhort them to avoid such an abyss of madness and blasphemy against Yeshua. I intend then to the best of my ability, with brevity and clearness, to set forth the opinions of those who are now promulgating heresy. I refer especially to the disciples of Ptolemaeus, whose school may be described as a bud from that of Valentinus, and I shall also endeavor, according to my moderate ability, to furnish the means of overthrowing them by showing how absurd and inconsistent with the truth are their statements. Okay, so what is Irenaeus' goal here? What is he trying to do? First of all, to whom is he addressing himself? To other early Christians, other early followers. Right, precisely, other early Christians. And what is his goal? What does he want to teach early Christians? The right beliefs. Now, the title of Irenaeus' book is not right belief. It is the opposite. It is against heresies. So how is Irenaeus teaching people right belief? By telling them the wrong beliefs. Ad nauseum. Irenaeus' work against heresy, which is really the earliest of its kind in sort of the mid to late second century, and then the genre really explodes. Irenaeus' work is the earliest exemplum of a genre called heresiology. Heresiology is, as the term suggests, or it's a sort of psychology, is if you break it down into its Greek components, is psychologos, which means, or rather, psychomologia, which means the study of the soul or of the mind. So heresiology would be the study of heretics. Now, heresiology, as it develops, Irenaeus sort of lists about 23 or 24 different flavors of heresy. But eventually the genre really takes off with Hippolytus, and then eventually sort of finding its apotheosis in the writings of a fellow named Epiphanius of Salamis, who's one of the great heresiologists of, I believe, the 4th or 5th century, who catalogs dozens and dozens and dozens for 100 different types of heresies. Now, the goal of heresiology is as follows. We need to do the right thing. We need to follow our early Christian beliefs. Now, the problem is, lots of different people think we should do lots of different things, and they're all wrong. Now, it is important, if we're going to know what the right thing to do is, to figure out all the different ways that different people are wrong. So, Ptolemaeus is wrong, as the name that appeared in this passage. Ptolemaeus is wrong. So, in order to figure out why he's wrong, we're going to go in great detail through everything that Ptolemaeus thinks, we're going to lay it out, we're going to argue against it, and then we're going to move on to the next thing. We're going to move on to Valentinus, and we're going to tell you all the different ways that Valentinus is wrong about everything, and so on and so on and so on. And we're going to go through the whole gamut of the early community, and we're going to tell you all the different ways that everybody else is wrong. The hope is that through this exercise of identifying every single bit of wrongness in our entire lives, that you're going to know what the right thing to do is. Now, this lends itself to a particular tone. If you had to guess, without having read Irenaeus, without having read Epiphanius, without having read Hippolytus, without having read Tertullian, what would you predict would be the tone of voice adopted by the heresiologists? Scornful. Mocking, cynical, skeptical. All sorts of things that produce a very particular way of being in someone who aspires, even wrongly as the early Christians did, to be an Ovid Hashem, to be a servant of God. Cynicism, mockery, scorn. That's the sort of tone of voice you find in early heresiology. Now, what's remarkable about heresiology is how popular it becomes. It takes off. It spreads throughout the ancient world, through Asia Minor, through the land of Israel, through early modern Western Europe. It spreads through Byzantium. Eventually, it spreads throughout the ancient world, but it is confined to the works and to the writings and to the communities of the early Christians. Now, my question to you is this. Does heresiology make its way into Chazal? Do Chazal have a concept of heresiology? Now, when I ask that question, I want to differentiate it from another question, which is, do Chazal have people whom they consider to be outside the bounds of their community on whatever grounds, which we'll explore in a moment? Those are two different questions. Certainly, every in-group has out-groups. To have if you want to stand for something, then there are going to be people who don't stand for what you do and who are therefore outside of your movement. So, every in-group has out-groups. Unquestionably, every in-group has to define to some extent their out-groups. What I am asking is, do Chazal have the genre of heresiology, where they meticulously go through all the different ways that people can be wrong, identify them, catalog them in a scientific fashion, as if you were doing taxonomy, and find out all the different ways that you can be wrong? Now, how would we answer this question one way or another? The answer could be yes. How do we answer this question? The answer would be, if we could find within Chazal a term for an outsider that refers to somebody specific, and we could perhaps find another term that refers to someone to some other specific group, then we could start to compile a dossier of evidence that Chazal were also heresiologists. Now, the term that we have on the table from earlier, which represents the term heretic, or which has been taken most closely to represent the term heretic in the literature of Chazal, is min. So let us ask ourselves now, the term min, what does it mean in Chazal? Now, early historians of Judaism from sort of 100 years ago assumed, with not unreasonably, we'll have to sort of limb their claims in just a moment, but not unreasonably, that the minim was sort of that minim at an early period was code for whom? The early Christians. In other words, when Chazal wanted to talk about Christians, they would use the term min. Now, why would early historians assume this? Where do we find the term min in our tefilos? We don't find it nowadays, but once upon a time, Birkas Haminim. V'lamalshinim altihi sikva, that bracha in Shemoneh Esrei originally had the term min. Right, v'chol haminim kerega, which we have still nowadays in certain nuschaot. Now, it happens to be that if you look into the Kairo Geniza, sort of a repository of some of our early texts from the medieval period, a treasure trove of unimaginable worth that has illuminated Jewish history in unparalleled ways, the Kairo Geniza has early versions of what Birkas Haminim looked like from early Sidurim. And in those early versions, as we find in some of the Rishonim as well, we find the bracha beginning with V'laminim V'lanotzrim Altihi Tikva. To the early Christians and to the Nazareans, there should not be any hope. So it does appear at a certain point that the word min takes on the meaning Christian. Now, let's ask ourselves, why would you need to disguise the reference to a Christian? Why wouldn't you just use the word notzuri in rabbinic literature? Because they're powerful, precisely. In other words, because they ruled Rome. Rome was extremely powerful. And at a certain point, you need to be Straussian about this. So, the question that we have to ask, therefore, is if we look at the earliest examples, we can actually exhaust them, because there aren't so many. If we look at the sum total of evidence in the Sifrut HaTanaim, in the literature of the early members of Chazal, the Tanaim, and we see all of the times or all of the different ways that they use the term min, we can ask ourselves, are they referring to early Christians? And if they are, then we have our answer. And if not, to whom are they referring? So let's take a look at the evidence. Source number 3 is from the Mishnah and Sanhedrin. The Mishnah and Sanhedrin tells us, Lefichach nivra adam yechidi ba'olam. Why? Shelo yomru haminim rishuyot harbei bashamayim. Therefore, this is part of an extended meditation in the Mishnah and Sanhedrin about Maaseh Breishis and other related themes. And the Mishnah concludes by telling us, therefore, the earliest human being was created as an individual, alone. Why? So that the Minim should not say that there are many powers in heaven. Now, before we identify the Minim, who they might be, let's break down the logic. If humanity, let's say there were two humans created at first, why would that give, let's say God created two early humans, Adam and Chava at the exact same time, why would that give license to the Minim to conclude that therefore there are multiple powers in heaven? Precisely. They'd say that each of the earliest creations was attributable to a different deity. And in fact, we have early sources from a place called Nag Hammadi in Egypt, which are date sort of from probably the 1st to the 3rd century, where we have interpretations of Bereshit that actually try to do precisely that. So this isn't an outlandish claim. Chazal are actually dealing with on-the-ground realities. Okay. Now, yes? Well, precisely. In other words, meaning there are places where, for reasons that have to do with early biblical features of early biblical Hebrew, Hashem will use the plural when he talks about creation. So, but that again is what gives rise to this discourse that perhaps there are multiple deities and there are all sorts of people who try to make all sorts of claims along those lines, and Chazal are dealing with them. Chazal are trying to ward against those claims. So in this case, Chazal are contending with people who believe that there were multiple powers in heaven. Could this describe plausibly early Christians? It could. In other words, it doesn't have to. There could be others, but it could describe early Christians. You have to fast forward a little bit to a time when Christians think that there are multiple godheads, which is a little bit later than the earliest Christians. But you can certainly plausibly articulate. Especially, listen, the Mishnah was put together in the early 3rd century of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So by the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, there certainly were early Christians that were running around thinking things like this. So the Minim in this case could be early Christians. Okay, take a look at the next verse. The Mishnah Megillah tells us, here's another place where the term min appears in the Sefer Tanaim. The Mishnah tells us, Ha'osa tfilaso agula, sakana, bnei she'ein ba mitzvah, nasna al mitzcho al pas yado, harizo derech haminus, tzipa zahav, nasna al beis yad, shel niklo, harizo derech hachitzonim. If a person makes his tefillin round, it's a danger because he's not fulfilled the commandment with it. So he's liable to an onesh. If he puts it on his forehead or the palm of his hand, this is the way of minus. If he overlaid it with gold or placed it on the sleeve of his cloak, this is the way of the chitzonim, of the outsiders. Now, before we engage with this source, let's review. The last source, what was the problem with the minim? What made a person a min in the source from Sanhedrin? Theism, right. In other words, believing in multiple beings, polytheism. What's wrong with polytheism? It's the wrong thing to believe. In other words, the problem is with what you believe. Okay, so that fits with the notion of heresy that we found in Irenaeus. It's believing the wrong thing. But what about in the Mishnah and Megillah? In the Mishnah and Megillah, what makes a person a min? If you put tefillin on your forehead, right? In other words, beinecha, literally beinecha, or on the palm of your hand, al yadecha, sort of which could be translated as in your hand. If you weren't following the Masorah. So, what makes a person a min in this case? Is it something you believe? It's something you do. In other words, you could say, listen, I believe in a Kadosh Baruch Hu, I believe in Erech, I believe in Torah Shabbat Peh, I believe in all these things. I'm just putting my tefillin where? Over here and over here. What's the big deal? The answer is, it's not about what you believe. What makes you a min is what you do. Now, an important point before we move on to the next source, because it will inform the next source. There's another group that appears in this source who is paralleled with the minim. In other words, if you put the tefillin in the wrong place, then you're a min. If you overlay it with gold, or you put it on the sleeve of your cloak, you're a chitzoni. So what is a chitzoni? What is a person who is chitzoni, who's outside? That appears to be a person who we might translate sort of into modern English as a separatist. Is a person who separates oneself from the community. Now, that will help us in terms of figuring out what a min is. Take a look at the source, at the next source there, from the Tosefta and Brachos. The Tosefta and Brachos tells us, and this is a source, and this is a source that we referred to earlier. Shmona Esrei Brachos Sha'amr Chachamim Keneged Shmona Esrei Askaros Shebahavu LaHashem B'nei Elim. There are 18 blessings that are part of the Amidah, of what we call the Shemona Esrei. Now, this is sort of the preface to an extended paragraph or an extended section over the course of which Chazal litigate which brachot are included amongst the Shemona Esrei. Now, if there are 18 brachos in the Shemona Esrei, if there are 18 brachos in the Amidah, how come Chazal didn't just list the brachos of the Amidah? What was the problem? So you could say, as the Bavli says, that there is at least allowed to be 19, which is Birkas Aminim is counted as a separate bracha. However, precisely. In other words, Chazal aren't mandating the Amidah. Chazal aren't inventing the Amidah. They're trying to standardize it. Now, as you can tell from this passage, there were lots of brachos, far more than 18. I mean, if you count up the brachos in this passage, you're going to get into the 20s. You're going to get maybe even into the 30s. There are tons of brachos that are flying around Yadus in the early period during the time of the Beis HaMikdash. Lots of people are saying lots of different things. Now, Chazal have a Kabbalah, and in this case, they append it to a pasuk of Havu LaHashem B'nei Elim, but Chazal appear to have a tradition, and this appears in multiple sources that deal with the Amidah, the final number should be 18. The question therefore becomes, which ones are in and which ones are out? Now, you have all these brachos, and many of them are ones that people are saying on the ground. So it's difficult to tell people, stop saying the bracha that you've said since you were a kid. So the solution that Chazal come up with in the Tosefta, and this is what the Tosefta does here, is Chazal try to do what? What do Chazal try to do? They will take different brachos that have similar themes and combine them together. So for example, Kolol Shel Minim B'Shel Prushim, B'Shel Gerim B'Shel Zakenim, B'Shel David B'Vanei Yerushalayim. Im Amar Eilel Atzman Ve'Eilel Atzman Yatza. Chazal, for example, combine the Birkas HaMinim, the bracha cursing the Minim, to the bracha against the Prushim, whatever that may mean. We'll leave that for a little bit later. They include the bracha blessing the Gerim with the bracha blessing the Zakenim, and that's a bracha that we have Ad Hayom Hazeh, Al Tzadikim. They include the bracha of David with the bracha of Bonei Yerushalayim. Now, whatever that may mean, that's one that the Rishonim struggle to interpret. However, the Tosefta includes, Amar Eilatzman Eilatzman Yatza. If you just say all of the brachos individually, it's not the best way to do things. You really should say a Shemona Esrei, a literal Shemona Esrei in 18 bracha Amida. If, however, you say the ones that you say by themselves, at least it's been Yote. Okay, so it's not 18's not Ma'akev, 18's the best way to do it. Okay. Now, in this case, Chazal include the bracha against the minim, which as we noted is lashon saginar, because it's really a klala against the minim. Chazal include the klala against the minim with the klala or whatever that may be against the prushim. Now, without going deep into the details of how this shakes out in Chazal, at least in the Tanaim, and how it shakes out in other literature, what problem might Chazal have had with the prushim? They certainly agree with them always about halacha. Well, those aren't klalos, but Birkas HaMinim is a klala and has the same exact theme as Birkas HaPrushim. Well, it can't be because it has the exact same theme as Birkas HaMinim. Yeah, so, what, yes? Right, so Chazal and Sota, multiple times in Sota, actually have very negative things to say about people who are Prushim. So this gets us to the core of the issue. When Chazal have negative things to say about the Prushim, very few and far between, because again, as far as Halacha is concerned, as Masorah is concerned, they agree with them. And they preserve their Masorah, and they defend them against people who are outside the community, the Tzedukim, and so on and so and the Baitusim, and so on and so forth. What is it about the Prushim that appear to have irked Chazal? And we can actually derive it from their very name. Where does the name Prushi come from? What does the name Prushi suggest about a person? Right, you're separate. And in fact, Chazal have a term for a person who separates themselves. What is this extended term? Who is not to be imitated. A poresh min hatzibur. A person who separates oneself from the community is not to be imitated and not to be admired. And in fact, if you look at all the different sources that describe Prushim, from Chazal to other sources as well, the common critique of the Pharisees of the Prushim is that they sort of made themselves separate from other people. So when Chazal have negative things to say about the Prushim, it is always about their behavior, and it appears to be, and the problem appears to be, down to the very name that the Prushim, that Chazal give to the Prushim, that they separated themselves. Now, that didn't mean that they were wrong about Halacha. In other words, they were right about Halacha. They are part of the Masorah, and they preserve the Torah Sheval Peh, and so on and so forth. But Chazal's problem with them was that they separated themselves. So, to bring it back now to our topic, if the problem in Sanhedrin was that a min believes the wrong thing, the problem in Megillah is that a person does the wrong thing, what's the problem here in the Tosefta? Is it about belief? No. Is it about what you do? Meaning, is it about violating a mitzvah? Is it about doing a mitzvah the wrong way? No. It's something more subtle. What's the problem with being a parosh or a prushi? Anhaga, right. Precisely, it is a social critique. It's a way of behaving that is wrong. It has nothing to do with belief. It has nothing to do with amunas v'deos. It doesn't have to do with issa v'heter. It just has to do with a way of being that is criticized. So, if that's the case, the problem with practice, let's say putting on tefillin the wrong way, can that be plausibly applied to the early Christians? It seems unlikely. In other words, we have no evidence from any early source including Christian sources, that the Christians were embroiled in machlokas with other people about how to put on tefillin. That certainly doesn't seem to have been the case. And certainly by the time of Irenaeus, that's not the case. What about simply behaving as if you're separate from everybody else? That, again, that could plausibly be the early Christians, but it also could not be. In other words, you read the early Gospels, so Yeshu is going around trying to bring the Kila together, and he accuses the Prushim of separating themselves. So it's very unlikely that the Minim refer to the early Christians. Certainly the bit about Tefillin cannot refer to the early Christians. So if that's the case, so who are Chazal referring to? Which community, specific community of people are they referring to? The answer is nobody. Chazal are not referring to a specific community. And in fact, if you go through all the places where Chazal use the term min, every single one, you will find that there is no consistent real-life community to whom the term min, or to whom the term minim, correspond. So what are Chazal doing when they use the category min, or minus? They are simply trying to signify any person who behaves in a way that sets them apart from our community, from our holy community, whether it's through believing something that is improper or impermissible, whether it is through doing something that is improper or impermissible, whether it is behaving in a way that's improper or impermissible, such a thing makes you a min. And how does that relate to the term min as we find it in Sefer Bereishis? What does the term mean in Sefer Bereishis? You said earlier, species. So I think the term min here, kifshuto, simply means someone who is distinctive for how they are. Whether it's by believing the wrong thing, whether it's by doing the wrong thing, whether it's by behaving the wrong way. This is about people who are setting themselves outside the community. But it is noteworthy, to return to our earlier question, do Chazal have heresiology? So we know the early Christians have heresiology. This person is wrong. Ptolemaeus is wrong for 15 different reasons. Valentinus is wrong for 17 other completely different reasons. And Hippolytus is wrong for 1,000 different reasons. Do Chazal have that notion of going through all the different ways of being wrong and categorizing them and doing taxonomy? No. Chazal have a catch-all term for people who are outside, and that is min. It doesn't correspond to anybody in particular. Chazal are not doing heresiology. Why is this important? Now again, let's return to the distinction we made earlier. Chazal certainly have a concept of outsiders. And more important than that, the notion, as some historians today articulate, that there's sort of nothing that can put you outside the community. You can kind of believe whatever you want as long as you're doing the right thing. Chazal do not appear to have that notion whatsoever. Chazal are very clear that there are things that you can believe, do, and there are ways that you can behave that do put you irrevocably outside the community. So Chazal have a notion of outsiderness. But crucially, what Chazal do not have, and they abstain from it precisely as the early Christians are going full steam ahead with it, Chazal do not have heresiology. Chazal do not focus on all the different ways of being wrong. And Chazal do not try to teach us about how to do the right thing by focusing on all the ways of being wrong. How do Chazal try to teach us to do the right thing? To tell you what the right thing to do is, precisely. Now, Chazal tell us, if you're an apikoros, you don't have a chelik olam haba. If you're this, you don't have a chelik olam haba. If you're a min, that's not a good thing. Chazal certainly have a sense that being wrong is bad, and it is impermissible. Of course they have that, and that's important. There are things that you can do that put you outside the community, and that is an important thing for our community to recall. If we're going to stand for something, then we have to have boundaries. That's important. But it is also important in terms of our worldview, our approach to life. How do we signal to ourselves and to the world around us that we stand for something? The way the early Christians did it was by focusing on all the things that put you outside. And by defining it in minute detail and going for pages and pages and having taxonomies of hundreds of different types of heresies that could put you outside the community. You're supposed to know from that what the right thing to do is. Chazal are the opposite. Chazal focus not on what puts you outside, but on what puts you inside. The vast majority of Chazal, you get through pages and pages of the Gemara, of the Mishnah, the Tosefta, all the way down to their end, to the Midrashei Halacha, the Midrashei Agada. Chazal are concerned with the values that put us inside. This is crucial in the era in which we live. We live in an era, whether it's religiously or politically or globally, we live in an era in which the temptation is to define ourselves by what we are not. this person is a manuvel of a journalist, and therefore what we think is right. This person is a terrible politician, and therefore my political beliefs are right. This person is a horrible person, and therefore my religious beliefs are right. There's such a focus nowadays, and you can document this in the economic literature, in the sociological literature. There's such a focus today on defining who we are against the wrongness of others. Heresiology is the order of the day. We are living in a heresiological age. Now, our responsibility as a people, as a Jewish people, our mission has always been to be counter-cultural, to stand, not to confirm the worst instincts of our society, but to oppose them, to stand for something that can teach our society how to behave in a way that is proper, kind, just, goodly, and most importantly, godly. Our responsibility is to tell the world, at this point in history, now our tafkid always changes, as history changes. At this point in time, one of our most important tafkidim is to stand before the heresiological culture that surrounds us and say, Ad kan and no further. If we want to be a society that can move ahead, that can build a beautiful world that is an olam chesed, that is an olam that reflects all of the values that God wishes to instill in us and all of the exacting moral correctness that God demands from us, then we need to begin articulating what that world is, not what that world is not. And I'll close, just if you give me 30 seconds, with a beautiful Chasam Sofer. Source number 4. Chasam Sofer, just in the interest of time, we'll do it outside. The Chasam Sofer asks the following question. He says, we're told in Chazal two different statements. We're told, Mishnichnas Av v'matin b'simcha, Mishnichnas Adar marbin b'simcha. When the month of Av comes in, we decrease our base level of happiness. And when the month of Adar arrives, we increase our base level of happiness. Now, crucially, the exhortation to decrease our happiness when Av comes in is accompanied in halachic literature by all sorts of specific practical prescriptions. Namely, we don't litigate against an akum, all sorts of things. Like we eat a certain way, we dress a certain way, all sorts of things. What about Mishnechnas Adar Marbin B'Simcha? What are the practical implications of Mishnechnas Adar? There aren't any. Chazal don't provide us with any. Moreover, says the Chasam Sofer, the halachic literature codifies the notion of Mishnichnas Av Mematin B'Simcha. Rambam and Shulchan Aruch, they tell us that it is a halacha, that when Av arrives, we need to decrease our positivity. But when it comes to Adar, there is no halachic obligation to be Marbin B'Simcha. We don't have to be Marbin B'Simcha. So all of the great codifiers, all of the great writers of Jewish legal codes do not insist halachically that we have to be Marbin B'Simcha. How can this be? So the Chasam Sofer tries out a bunch of different answers. He's not really satisfied by any of them. Luli Mistafina, and of course the Chasam Sofer, you should look at the Chasam Sofer's answers because they're all fascinating. On the basis of the foregoing, I humbly submit a possible suggestion for what the answer might be. As a people, we have a mission to act positively in history, to build up a sense of what our mission is by articulating what it is, not what it is not. As a people, our responsibility is to articulate our mission to the world b'simcha always. It is the heresiologists who are mematin b'simcha. It is the heresiologists who go through life criticizing everybody else and cataloging all the ways in which everybody else is wrong and obsessing about everybody else's wrongness rather than focusing on their rightness. Our baseline character as a people is that we are b'simcha. So to be marbin b'simcha doesn't need to be mandated. That is our natural inclination as a people. We are always pushing forward. We are always acting positively in history. Even as a people who have been downtrodden and as oppressed as we have been a people who have saturated this world and human civilization with rigorous thinking, with sophisticated writing, with positive thinking, and even a sense of humor. As Jewish, I mean, the Jewish comedian is sort of a byword in Hollywood. We are a people who are known for our simcha. So Mishnechnas Adar Marbin B'Simcha doesn't need to be mandated. That's our natural inclination as a people. Mishnechnas Av Matin B'Simcha must be mandated because that's not who we are. We are heresiologists. We are living in an age of heresiology. We must be positive thinkers as the inheritors of Chazal. We certainly have minim, and we can never forget that. There are things that can put us outside the community.
But ultimately, we are people whose responsibility is to articulate a positive message for the world, a positive sense of our own identity, and expect people to conform to it on a positive, affirmative basis. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day. I think we may have time, I guess, for one. I don't want to be mocky if really Simon is waiting. Right. That's true. The Chasam Sofer has that reputation in history. There's a wonderful book which I recommend by Ma'oz Kahana about the Chasam Sofer and the Old Behuda, which I think puts that in context. The Chasam Sofer was a relentlessly positive thinker. That has been an exaggerated as element of his biography. It's a good point. Yes. Yeah.